Let me sit here where people can see me. I know when I was over there, you couldn't see me, so I'll kind of scooch over like that. Hi, I'm Karen. I am a grateful member of a number of fellowships, kind of. Do you want me to use a mic?
Yeah.
I think so.
Is it on? Let me try.
God.
That's on. Is it better if I stand up?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll do it like that.
Fistful of things to try to keep me happy here, kind of in case I go blank and can't think of what to say. Should I start again?
No, it's okay. Do you want to put that in?
I'm not sure.
There it goes. How's that?
Don't know. We'll see. How's that? All righty. I heard that we frequently begin with a moment of silence, and I listened to a speaker who said that he personally asked Lois, the founder of Al-Anon, what she did in that moment of silence. And she answered, she invites God into the meeting. And it's not because God isn't always there, but it's with this perception that God is a gentleman and comes where invited and doesn't stay where is not welcome. So I'd like to take just a moment of silence. Thank you. I've been encouraged by the earlier meeting where I realized that so many people here belong to multiple fellowships, and I am well aware I was asked to give an Al-Anon share. I don't know how to give anything else, but it's likely to touch on outside issues. That is, my first Al-Anon meeting was in 1989 in September, so that makes it 36 years this month. To my astonishment, I should be a lot better than I am already, but there you go. You only get what you get. I got sober in AA in 2001, and last Monday I had 8,888 sober days, and that makes my sobriety date 2001, I've got 24 years, 4 months, and 4 days of sobriety. But the beginning of the story is always Al-Anon, I think, for me certainly. Kind of, I was the oldest in a family with 6 children. But there was me and my brother were growing up in the Midwest, and my mom and dad had a restaurant and they worked late, so my brother and I were boarded out. So I was boarded out in various changing families until I was about 8 years old, when she decided to fall in love with my dad's best friend and divorced my dad and married the best friend and had 4 more children in pretty quick succession, and there I was. I was 8 years old when that first of those other 4 brothers were born, and I was the built-in babysitter. I would sit in the crib with them because they decided to let him cry, and that didn't feel right to me. And so I took care of a lot of babies. I changed a lot of diapers. I did a lot of that stuff. I was a responsible little person. What's strange in my memory about what my mom was doing with me was that I think when I was around 10 years old, and this doesn't quite jive with the facts that I can remember, the room I remember being in when she told me this, I don't think I was there already by the age of 10, but it was quite young, and she told me that I had been an accidental pregnancy, accidental birth, and they had planned to give me away. But I was such a cute baby that she kept me, and when my dad came back about 6 months later, he decided he'd stay and they'd make a family out of it. And I've always had this odd feeling of, you know, you were a cute kitten, but now you're grown up, sort of feeling. So it's quite sure that I was raised by my mom. I mean, that's, the two of us are so similar in our appearances, in our gestures, in our manner of speaking. There's all kinds of things that people who never saw us together ever said, "Do you know Rosalie?" I said, "Yeah, that's my mother." My mom, it took until COVID for me to begin to understand why she might have done that, because that was something that felt like I was cut off at the knees or something. I just didn't have any basis for like who I was or where I was or how accidental it was that I was in this family as a stepchild. But during COVID, kind of in some long talks with Al-Anon members, the meeting after the meeting, as it were, I came up with a plausible explanation, because I don't think she did these things deliberately or out of any intention to harm, but I think she was a narcissist, and I think she didn't recognize that other people had feelings. And I think what could have been going on, because she's passed on, I can't ask her anymore, but what could have been going on was she was making me into her confidant. I was the oldest of six children, the only girl, built-in confidant. I don't remember her having any close friends, ever. And so, at least for me, it's a little bit of a something that soothes me a little bit to have some logical reason why she would have behaved this way, which is a classic abusive behavior of a young child. When I was 15, 16, my stepfather decided that I looked just like my mother and he could kind of take advantage of that situation. And I wound up talking to a teacher at school, and I just packed bags and moved out, and I said I just needed to get some room to study for midterm exams in high school. The teacher helped me organize getting into the dormitory at Wayne State University. So my 17th birthday, I was studying like crazy, trying to pass my finals for high school, while everybody in the dorm for the university had finished their classes and were, "Oh no, but classes are over," and I was turning 17. So it was a funny situation. My mom told my brothers I left because I didn't love the family anymore and I was trying to destroy them. Because, of course, if anybody believed anything I was saying about their father, that could have been criminally prosecuted. And it took a long time before I was willing to stay in the house with them again. It happens. I met someone, of course. Who doesn't? And although I knew I didn't want to get married for a long time, 2 weeks after I turned 18, I married a man who was 11 years older than me, and I think he was trying to tie down a good thing. And he kind of took the point of view that he was rescuing me from a terrible, terrible family. And, you know, I was 18. It's taken me like 50 years after that to recognize how big an influence that was in my evaluation of what my childhood was like and how unhappy it was. I believe now very firmly that it's never too late to have a happy childhood. I believe that with the help of the steps, I can reframe things in a way that I can recognize which part was bad. It's not that it was all good, but some of it was bad and a lot of it was good, and, you know, most of it was more than okay. And to reframe that, and I no longer start my stories with "I had an unhappy childhood," but this is something I had to really look at and kind of reframe and deal with. 18. We got divorced when I was 25, and I thought, well, it was the end of the world, because, of course, that first great love will never be repeated. Thank goodness I was wrong. I mean, this is just like one of those delusions. I really thought when I married this man that if I could make him happy, I would be happy. A 1950s kind of a woman. I thought I could make him happy. And this was someone who was determined not to be happy. So that wasn't going to happen either. Clearly, he was 11 years older than me. We got married 2 weeks after I turned 18. He did not want me to go back to college because there might be competition from other men. It was really this kind of claustrophobic comes to mind, but it didn't feel like that. It just felt like there wasn't too much room to spread my wings and do things. But I was looking for work, and I looked in the paper, and in those days, you had a great big column for men wanted, great big pages of women wanted, and there was about a column and a half, like right in the middle, men or women. And they wanted data processing professionals. Now, that in those days, it was called data processing rather than IT, information technology. And so I started taking night school courses, and that was, I excelled at that. And I started out slow and kind of gained speed and became eventually kind of, a senior systems analyst kind of person. And I like that kind of work very much. And I was very lucky because in those days there wasn't anything like a college degree that they gave you qualifications. So a few night school classes were enough to get me indoors and do the interviews and get jobs. We moved to New York City. Eventually we separated and got divorced. I'm bumping around New York City, a single New York City kind of woman, and I did the kind of things that one does in those circumstances, and there were some good times, you know, and there was, my impression was that, you know, this disappointment about not being able to make this man happy, this disappointment about the illusion that if I could just make somebody else happy, that would make me happy. I kind of went into these binges of two-year-long relationships with men. If I wasn't in a relationship, obviously I was lonely because I needed a partner. If I was in a relationship and I was still lonely, obviously it was the wrong man. So I would say my first drug of choice was this kind of affection addiction. I just wanted to be wanted. I wanted to be loved the way I wanted to be loved, and I don't think there's anybody on earth who could do that. Nothing was enough. And I would have these relationships where the first year, maybe, I'm thinking, this is it, this is the one that's going to do it. And the second year, I'm going, how do I get out of this? You know, and that was repeated several times. I had a very unhappy breakup with a man I thought I was very much in love with. And I decided New York City wasn't big enough for both of us, and I moved to Europe. I still had my apartment there, and one of my brothers came and lived in my apartment. And I started bouncing around Europe kind of the same way I'd been bouncing around New York City. And I bumped into this guy in Paris one time that was, I don't know, I've had a series of bad boyfriends, what can I say? But he was interesting. He was an art dealer, and I could get all dressed up and go to these auctions with him and kind of play the part of army candy and that sort of thing. And when that wasn't going so far, I eventually started looking for work. And because IT at that time is very English-centric, it probably still is, I could get work. And I started working in Europe, and then I don't think I ever worked in the States again after that. I just stayed here a lot of the time I wasn't working. I went to Greece one time on a trip before I went back to a contract, and you'll never guess, I met a man. And I called up work and I said, look, I'm just going to be a bit late. I've been offered a trip to a trip to Corfu, and I just really want to go to Corfu with this, and I'll be there in a month. And so guess what? We didn't go to Corfu. Who would have guessed? We went to Crete instead. But when I called the job back to see what was going on, they said, you know, we found someone else to replace you because you didn't really seem very enthusiastic about coming back. And it was like the weight of the world fell away from me. I was not unhappy about this solution. But of course, we paddled around until I was pregnant. I left him there in Crete and went back to see my family at Christmas time, pregnant. I'm going to tell them that's when I'm pregnant. And I figured I gave him time to get away if he didn't want to be part of it, because we say all these loving things when we're with one another. But when I got back, he was still there. Darn. So eventually, I took him to the States with me. That's kind of too long to fit into this, but kind of... That wasn't exactly the proper right way, and so I took him into the States with me. We had a baby. We went traveling for a while, and they picked him up at in Texas while we were driving around. And as he was in, had illegally entered the country with my kind help, he was picked up and incarcerated. And you know, I went and bailed him out and took him home and. You know, found a lawyer who would handle the case and did all that kind of stuff. I don't know. My whole life feels kind of like I'm a ball in a pinball machine, and I'm kind of heading sort of in this direction. Wham! Comes the flipper. Oh, no, I guess I'm heading in that direction. Wham! Comes another flipper. Oh, we're doing something else entirely. I didn't understand people who had, like, a plan and went forward. And did a plan. I thought you came with an instruction book that I didn't get. There are still things I bump into about social niceties that everybody seems to know what you're supposed to do, and it's a total mystery to me still. I have to be open to instruction about how you be nice to people and how you do things, because apparently it's not inbuilt. There's some thing about that that I just never quite got. What do I want to tell you about? One of my boyfriends in New York was a very heavy drinker. And that was a real difficult time. I think my first husband was a not terribly heavy drinker, but really consistent. So there was all this kind of background of alcohol in my history there that I never recognized as anything particular. And when I started to break up with my husband, we had the first child, then we got married, then we had another child, then we got legally domiciled in Belgium, and then we broke up. And a friend of mine, her husband was drinking a lot. And about this same time, it was 1989, my youngest child was 3 years old, and she took me to my very first Al-Anon meeting. And it was an open Al-Anon meeting with a speaker. And to my astonishment, I felt really warm. I felt really safe, which was not a feeling I was particularly used to. And I really liked it, and I kept going back to Al-Anon. I continued to go to Al-Anon. This woman was probably healthy enough. She didn't need that continual support. So she didn't continue for that long, but I did. But at just about the same time, her husband took me to my very first AA meeting. And that was a speaker meeting. It was an open speaker meeting. And my sense of identification with the alcoholic was very powerful. And when I had been young, I drank consistently, and I would say with a bit of talent and natural ability. When my children were born, I'd stopped drinking that way. In fact, in Greece, they noticed right away that I started to refuse the raki that came with breakfast and things like that. Karen, you're not drinking. Would you like some wine instead? No, thank you. Are you pregnant? It was the first thing people asked in Greece when I stopped drinking. So it was that obvious. I had been drinking that consistently. When I was pregnant, I couldn't handle alcohol. Almost, I tried. A shot of Kahlua in a whole glass of milk. It still made me awfully, awfully ill, and so I stopped drinking alcohol during the pregnancy. And then I got, I would say, perhaps distracted by taking care of a newborn baby, and I didn't find the need to keep drinking then. But I started going then to, I had that first Al-Anon meeting and that first AA meeting. And I went to AA, sorry guys, I'm going to just tell you my story. It's the only one I really have, and I'll mix it up a little bit. I went to AA for a few closed meetings, and I found out that they were concerned about somebody who was going to closed meetings who had no apparent desire to stop drinking. And as I'm the only person in the world who has ever done that, I knew they were talking about me. And so I talked myself right back out of AA. And I continued to go to Al-Anon, and I continued to go to open AA meetings. And what I did in Al-Anon, what a lifesaver. I don't know what I would have done otherwise. It taught me so much. You know, we've got all these wonderful little sayings in Al-Anon. I cling to these little things because they're easier for me to remember than bigger pictures. So we've got the three C's. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. This stuff is not my fault if it's going on around me. I love the acronym THINK. This is your filter for whether I should say something, and I have to remind myself about this still. T, is this thoughtful? Is it honest? Is it intelligent? Is it necessary? Is it kind? And if it doesn't pass these filters, I don't need to say anything about this. My sponsor will still catch me up sometimes on things I want to tell my son. I think somebody should tell him because who else could do it? She says, did he ask you? Well, no. Well, then what is your question? I learned really a lot in Al-Anon. But unfortunately, I never did the steps. I did take Blueprint for Progress home with me. I kept it on my bedside table. I even sometimes looked at it. I resisted enormously actually doing the exercises. I didn't have a sponsor who really worked with me, or perhaps I should say that I really worked for whatsoever. I had a few people who tried. And about the time that I was getting into AA, I had a black belt Al-Anon sponsor who took me aside when I was very, very unhappy about, I don't know, which breakup with which boyfriend, I can't remember right now, I don't think it really matters, but you know, weeping inconsolably, he lied to me, you know, he died. And she sat me down and we did the work. And she worked with me out of the big book. So this is my toughest Al-Anon sponsor ever, worked with me out of the big book and took me through the big book. And we did step one and two and three. And in her kitchen, we got on our knees together and said the third step prayer. And she sat me down at her kitchen table. She said, you can choose a pen or a pencil. Here's the paper. You can choose if you want coffee or tea, and you start writing now. And I don't know how I would have climbed that Mount Everest without that direct, immediate shove. And I did a fifth step with her, which took forever because she kept watching me. As long as I carried fear around it, she kept telling me to write more. Write more about your mother. Write more about this. Write more about... And finally, when I came back with something and I could smile through the fifth step work, and she said, if anything else comes up, do you know what to do with it? I said, yeah, I do. I know how to do this. And she said, okay, we're finished. We finished your fifth step. But I'm moving back to the United States, and I'm going to warn you, do not stop anywhere between step 4 and step 9. These are the action steps. There is no comfortable place in there to wait and see what happens next. You really have to go through the steps to get the value of them. And so the next time a study group started up, which was something that was a fairly recent phenomenon in my home group, I joined the study group. I said, oh, I don't have to do a fourth step. I just did one. I said, no, we don't have any observers here. You do another one. And I found that every time I do a fourth step, probably about once a year since then, because whatever debris there is in my mind will come up when I offer it that filter and try to see what's going on. And the first fourth step had 35 pages about resentment about that boyfriend. 35 pages! I'm sorry, which one of us was crazy? 35 elaborate... I'll fall across that paperwork or something. I have no idea. But... I'm not the same person I was then. My ability to turn things and look at them from a different perspective is entirely different. So every time I do this, I get enormous value from it. Let's see, in Al-Anon, I was the GR for a while. We ran for 5 years, we ran an Alateen group. I have the unusual privilege of having done service, quite a lot of service, both in Al-Anon and in AA, and having been vilified in both fellowships for working for the other fellowship. So it's kind of an interesting perspective, because when I was the GR for the Alateen group, because I was the only person there who was qualified to do it as the Alateen sponsor, the Alateens were not allowed to be the GRs themselves because it would put someone underage in a car with someone overage to get to their meetings and stuff like that. So it was required that it was the Alateen sponsor who represented the group. But people treated me very, very badly in those assemblies. We have an alcoholic among us. I'm going to invite anyone who is in Al-Anon to be welcoming and gentle with the AAs who come across your path. And I will invite the AAs not to make stupid jokes about Al-Anons if you don't know what's going on in there. Both of these programs save lives, as does the Alateen Fellowship. And that group lasted for 5 years. I was very, very dedicated to it. And then it fell apart, as some good things do. Service. Let's see, what's come out of my service is one of the things somebody said to me is service will be good for your recovery, and it won't always be pretty to watch. So one of the things that I kind of cling to as something that I'm willing to do, it took me a long time because I wanted everybody to like me. And now I'm prepared to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And I'll wear that hat, and I'll do that if that seems to be the right thing to do, is to stand up for what I believe and what I think is correct and right. I'm going to go trouncing into talking about the steps because I just love the steps incredibly. This is something that I do now because I've fallen into this group of people who did step work together. I found that working in a group assuaged a lot of my fear around doing the work, and it also kept me from procrastinating indefinitely. I'm a master procrastinator. And if I work in with a group of people, I don't want to come back in a week and say, oh, I didn't do my homework. And it'll really give me that momentum, that boost to keep up with the group, the forward motion, doing the homework and coming back and reporting back to the group. So for me, it was a much more effective way than, for me personally, it was a much more effective way than working one-on-one with my sponsor, because I could come back to my sponsor far too often and say, yep, I didn't do it yet. And when she said, call me when you've done it, I could disappear for months. So working in a group changed this for me. So this is something that I do now. I gather up everybody I can from any kind of 12-step fellowship that wants to work out of the big book, because the directions there are very straightforward, they're simple. It's simply stated for simple people. And it takes, the groups that I run take between 5 and 6 months probably to get from the title page of the big book, and we read all the way through Dr. Bob's Nightmare, so it's 188 pages instead of 164, and we read everything and have an opportunity to discuss it and see how it fits into the program, how it works for you, whichever fellowship you're in. And I haven't seen anyone get all the way to the end of that without having a spiritual experience. There's no way to do all of the work without getting there. And you know what? The work doesn't care what your motivation is. It doesn't care what why you're doing it, if you want to do it or if you don't want to do it. So long as you do it, you get the results. It's absolutely amazing. I thought in the beginning that I would learn about the steps. And once I learned about the steps, I would do them. But of course, that left me sitting in my meetings for about 2 years. Now, I'm not even talking about the Al-Anon meetings, 10 years of Al-Anon meetings, where we read the steps at the beginning of every meeting. But I didn't have any intention of doing them. And when I finally got into AA, we're still reading the steps at the beginning of every meeting, and I was miserable. I was just twisting around like a puppet on the end of a string without being able to get a grip in any kind of direction. And I started doing the step work again like this in a serious forward motion kind of way. But I thought I couldn't do step 1 and 2 and 3 because I don't believe in God. I don't believe you believe in God. I don't believe in faith. I don't want to believe in God. And where are you going to go in step 1 and 2 and 3? And so, again, just a few years ago, it occurred to me that I had everything I needed for step 1 and 2 and 3 right in the beginning. And I like the acronym for God, Gift of Desperation. Whew, I don't know anyone who gets into AA without that. Probably not Al-Anon either. Al-Anon, I followed a friend into Al-Anon. It wasn't that I didn't need it, but I hadn't figured it out on my own. But people who come in and sit down in the seat, that's what it is. It's a desperation, and it's like the last house on the block, and it's like, where else can I possibly go with the misery that I'm carrying right now? My God acronym for step 2 is Group of Drunks, because although What I thought I wanted was a Polaroid, Charlton Heston, white robe, golden throne, you know, and here, this is it, this is God. And of course, that's not what I wanted because it wasn't what I could believe in. But my group of drunks, my home group, clearly had more information about how to live a decent life, a sober life, and get from here to there than I did, than anything I could put together. And my God acronym for step three is good, orderly direction. And I believe that that began to be a part of my life the very first time I was willing to do something my sponsor asked me to do before I could understand it, which was almost all of the time, but I was, for so long, if I didn't understand why, then I just, you know, never got any traction. I never did the stuff. And just start doing what I was told to do without trying to figure out why it could work. So pray on your knees, morning and night. I don't believe, I don't care if you believe, you know, God, that's not, I didn't ask you if you believe. I asked you to do it. So that's the way the step study group works too. I said, I don't care if you believe, I don't care what you believe, but I'm going to ask you to do it like this. It's a formula. It's kind of like a recipe for a cake. If you do all the things I ask you to do, you will probably get the same kind of cake that I got in the end. But if you decide, you know, you don't need the salt and you don't know what baking powder does and you don't like coconut, you're going to leave that, you might not get the same cake that I made for you. Step four. I thought step four was like Mount Everest. It was so scary, so scary. I couldn't begin to get there. And now when I begin a step four, I do it with a light heart because I know I just get to look at, I get to look at my resentments, you know, and this is my own personal area of expertise. Nobody knows what these are about better than I do. And I write them down and I've got this systematic way to work on them so that I turn them around so that I can see what my character defect has been in there, either to create the situation or to continue the situation so that I can stay resentful and the other person's probably not home thinking about me. And sometimes they are the way to resolve these things is not really direct, and that's kind of a talent too that we get to that in a minute. Step five is such an incredibly, and it's personal, it's a sharing on a very deep level with another person. I have been the recipient of really a lot of step fives from people. Because again, in the group, I tell people, look, a step four has the shelf life of lettuce. It does not have the shelf life of a can of beans. If you write this, you have to sit down with somebody and deal with it right away. So if your sponsor is on a three-month sabbatical, come to me. I'll do your step five with you. It's okay. You can do it again when your sponsor's free. But do it right now. Do it right away so that you've got the value of all the work that you put into it. Step five will help to reveal the character defects that are brought to light in these resentments. Step six and seven, in the big book, the really short little paragraph, are you willing to give up your defects of character? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Step seven, say this prayer. Okay, said it. We're done. Step eight. I found a book called Drop the Rock in one of the conventions that I went to and talked to the man who was selling books. He said, I don't know why, I still have three copies of this left. These always go immediately. I said, it's that good? He said, yes, it is. And it's a book about step six and step seven. And it just shines a light on what this process is. What is it to become willing to give up my character defects, because we cling to these things. It's amazing, but the worst ones are the ones that cling to the hardest. And step seven, humbly ask to be rid of them, humbly ask for them to be taken in God's time, in God's way. So it's not necessarily going to be immediate, but I have to become willing. It's that willingness. Isn't that magic? Step 8 will come directly out of my step 4. Step 8 will contain everybody on there that I had a resentment toward, and I will sit down and I will try to reflect if I can think of anyone that I have done harm to. And if I can't, even if they weren't on my resentment list somewhere, I will add them to that list. And I will suggest to people in the study group that they break that list into 3 parts. The people I'm willing to make amends to, the people I'm, well, not yet. Okay, I'm not ready. And then the never even when hell freezes over list. These are there. They should be on the list. You should have a list of who they are. But even if you cannot imagine ever making amends to these people, they should be on your list. And step 9 is this practice of how to make an amend. And depending on somebody's background, it typically people imagine, they look at this and they imagine it's an apology. I'm sorry, I did this. And the big book says very clearly, it is not another muttered apology. You know, everybody's tired of hearing these. Or people think it's a confession. And I've seen like a television series where somebody said, yeah, I'm doing a 9th step with you and I need to tell you I slept with your sister on our wedding day. And I'm going, you know, it is so poorly misrepresented in the media and all kinds of places, and probably in meetings and by some sponsors. An amend is mending of a relationship. And the formula that I like to use is, this is a character trait. You know, when we dealt with one another about this, I was selfish. I could not see your point of view. I acted badly because I didn't understand correctly. And it is not begging for an apology. It's an acknowledgement of what I did there. And so far, I have not seen that formula go too badly. It's not the exact formula that will work with everybody, but it's something that goes, it's accepting my, it's not the part of the bad thing that I did, but accepting responsibility for my defects of character and how I've let him poison this relationship for so long. So I had a way to make amends with my stepfather. I had a way to make amends with my mother. You know, I had a formula for dealing with people about this in a way that didn't wound me and didn't shove their face in what they had done. And I can promise you that the difference between making like almost all of your amends or making all of your amends is a world of difference. So if you ever get to that point and you've got that list, you will find that as you do the ones that you're ready to do, that the ones that you're not yet ready to do, they kind of come into focus for what you want to do with them. And amazingly, these people will start to pop up in your life. They'll be next to you in the line at the supermarket, or you'll bump into them in a restaurant that neither one of you were ever in before. That the opportunity will be presented. But by the time that happens, you should have the vocabulary, you should have the knowledge of what you want to say to this person. You know, and how you would say it. You know, and not just go, oh, I need to make an amend. But that's this practice of working through what you'll say in your 9th step amends. Then we get to step 10, 11, and 12. And these things are frequently called maintenance steps. And I prefer to call them growth steps because they really give you an opportunity to repeat, like, basically everything that you've done from step 4 through step 9. But kind of on a kind of quick and ongoing way. In the big book, it's very clear that step 10 is what you do during the day, face to face with somebody. You've done something. Oops, wait, I shouldn't have done that. I hope that didn't offend you. I hope it doesn't bother you as much as it bothers me, but I shouldn't have done it like that. I should have done it otherwise. You know, let's back up and do that. Get a do-over on that. The step 10 is this immediate watching what you do through the day. In the big book, again, it's very clear that this review of your day in the evening is part of step 11. So it's, I don't care, I don't have any desire to fight with anybody about what they want to call step 10 or step 11, I don't care. But for me, when I look at it in the big book, step 11 is this this review at night of the day that's gone by. If there's something that needs to be told to someone, you try to find the way to tell it. And again, when you wake up in the morning, you aim yourself in the right direction. Have a prayer for where you're going today and what you're going to do. Set on the right direction. And step 12. Hi, guys. Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. If I've done these steps, I have a message that I can carry to someone else. And I don't know what the message is that I should carry if I haven't done these steps and had a spiritual awakening. So I was listening in the meeting earlier and just kind of had a number of things that people mentioned that, I don't know, a long time ago somebody came into our AA room and she rearranged the slogans on the wall. She said, the way I learned it is, live easy but think first. So live and let live. Easy does it, but for the grace of God, think, first things first, and I can have the other one's kiss, just keep it simple, you know. So I've got those six slogans at hand all the time. I don't think anybody else in my home group ever paid attention to that at all, but I've remembered, this must be 20 years ago, this lady came in and rearranged the slogans on our wall. Just at lunchtime today, I was talking about the... Okay, my timer says 12 minutes left, but that's perfect.
Oh, okay.
That's okay, I put an hour. You don't have to give me an hour.
I'm sorry. Just go ahead.
That's all right, because I finished all the part that I really wanted to say. We were talking at lunch, I was talking about, in my mind, I see a relationship between surrender and acceptance, and they come so close together in the way that I behave and the way that they happen. What else was there? Something else I really was desperate to say. I think if you're feeling that time is up, that I can just finish on that note. And I just want to say, if nobody told you today they love you, I love you so profoundly, really, really, you don't know. And thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you for the team to put this together. Dembry, I can't imagine how you had the courage to invite me to speak to you today, but love you. Thanks.